This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. As a way of tracking the housing crisis, our Planet Money team bought a toxic asset. It's filled with home loans from across the country, some from people who borrowed more than they could afford. But it turns out this Planet Money asset contains something else, at least one mortgage that could be part of a $200 million mortgage fraud scheme. NPR's Hannah Jaffe-Walt takes a look at one Sarasota house in that scheme, a house that was bought and sold six times in 4 years and more than tripled in value.
The first person to own the home was probably the last man who truly loved that house on Cove Terrace Road.
Fred Bloom is my name.
Fred Bloom?
Fred Bloom. Isn't that a great name for an allergist?
Dr. Fred Bloom, the allergist, met me outside the Cove Terrace house. It's nice. Four bedrooms, red tile roof. It's painted that sort of Florida peachy color. It's got a pool and a boat dock.
It had a two-story family room with windows up above, and you could sit there and watch lightning, and you could watch the sky.
Dr. Bloom's kids grew up. He and his wife separated, and he reluctantly put the house up for sale.
And it didn't sell, and it didn't sell, and it didn't sell.
And
I wasn't happy about that. I was not happy about lowering the price.
And then we had an offer from Craig Adams.
This is Candy Swick, Dr. Bloom's real estate agent. Now, getting an offer from Craig Adams was nothing to sneeze at. Adams was well known in Sarasota as a guy who could make any deal happen. Some even used the word genius.
Craig's offer was very good. It was right on the mark, and it was like, this is good. Take it and run. It's been enough time.
And I resisted as long as I could and then decided the fight is over. So I caved in.
Dr. Bloom sold the house for $600,000, much less than he wanted for it. And then, 2 weeks later, he's at the grocery store and he runs into his former Cove Terrace neighbors. Hey, how you doing? How are the new people on the block?
And they told me that my house had sold again. And he mentioned the price of $725,000. And I was really upset. And I said, that's $125,000 more than I got for it. And that was only a matter of a couple of weeks.
Oh, it was weeks?
It was just a matter of a couple of weeks. Yeah, I was not happy.
That is an understatement. Dr. Bloom was furious at his real estate agent and held on to that resentment for 10 years. 10 years until what really happened at Cove Terrace came out.
My name is Matthew Doig. I'm an investigative reporter at the Sarasota Herald Tribune.
Doig and his colleagues have been piecing together what they say could be a $200 million mortgage scheme led by Craig Adams.
Adams put together the deal and apparently took it to his associate, a guy named Steve Wexler, and just basically said, here's this deal, sign on the dotted line. Don't worry about it. You're not even going to own this property that long. In 2 weeks, we're going to sell it to our buddy Keyworth for $725,000.
Doig explains, here's how this would work. Adams had a group of friends and associates, and one would buy a house, sell to another and another for higher and higher prices. The sales wouldn't get listed publicly, and Adams would set the prices. With each sale, someone would take out a loan that would pay off the previous loan. And since it was bigger than the last one, there'd be extra cash to split among the players.
After Dr. Bloom is out of the picture, that house is completely controlled by Craig Adams. And every time it is sold, Adams is representing both the buyer and the seller.
In 4 years, the Cove Terrace house had six owners and went from $600,000 to more than $2 million. Dr. Bloom became more and more confused. The house didn't look any better. In fact, it looked worse.
Occasionally, I would drive by the house, and at various times, the yard was really in disrepair.
When it was in disrepair, did it look like no one was living here?
Yes, it looked like it was vacant.
Guy Sakala is publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance, and he says he's seen this sort of thing all over the country. As long as there's a housing bubble, it works pretty well.
The idea is if you can keep selling a house for more than you're borrowing, you'll always make out ahead. You know what?
Eventually, it's a loan. You eventually have to pay the bank back.
Correct. There wasn't a great exit strategy. You know, in hindsight, these weren't geniuses figuring out these plans.
By 2007, the Cove Terrace house was owned by yet another associate of Craig Adams, a guy who defaulted on more than $2 million in loans. The bank foreclosed on the house. Now, the banks or lenders clearly lose big time in this scenario. They kept handing out loans because they, too, were caught up in the bubble. With home values rising so quickly, who's to say that six owners in 4 years is really all that strange?
It's a fine line between what's a legitimate real estate investment and committing actual fraud.
Sakala says, look, we have a reality TV show about flipping houses. At the height of the bubble, a third of the people buying properties were never planning to live in those homes. That doesn't mean all those loans were fraudulent, but mortgage fraud doesn't have to be all that dramatic. It can be just fudging your income a little. The FBI is looking into more than 3,000 cases of mortgage fraud right now. And in Sarasota, they're doing it with the help of Craig Adams. The Herald Tribune has reported that he's gone from real estate genius to FBI informant. Hannah Jaffe Walt, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. And for the next segment in our Thrilled to Death series, we're going to spend some time with the author Stephen Carter. Carter is a law professor who began his writing career in the 1990s as a nonfiction author, tackling heady issues such as religion and affirmative action. In 2002, he turned to fiction with a best-selling conspiracy thriller called The Emperor of Ocean Park. He says story and plot twists are important, but it all begins with well-crafted characters.
I always first imagine characters I want to write about. With my first novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, which is the story of a family's search for what really happened to the patriarch of the family, who was a disgraced federal judge, I began with the vision of this judge, this very conservative black federal judge who had been enormously successful and then had had a scandalous life, had been disastrous. And I was interested in the effect that would have on his family. And it was writing about the effects on his family that led me then to imagine the family and the story.
Have you read a lot of thrillers yourself?
I have. I cut my eye teeth, I think, on the thrillers of John le Carré, for example, although when I was younger, I suppose I read a lot of Robert Ludlum, too.
I was going to ask you what were your favorites and if there are certain scenes that you remember in those books that you can still recall with great clarity because they just put you right inside the action.
There are a number of scenes that I remember as enormously vivid. From the novels of John le Carré. In his novel, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, there's a scene where he just describes two men driving from one place to another to further the solution to a mystery, and they're simply talking about it. But the shadows around the drive, if you will, the shadows of memory, the horrors that have gone on around them that they're thinking about, even though they're not threatened at that moment, just the way he describes this, so that it's in the background as they talk, is enormously chilling.
When you're writing a thriller, how is the process different than when you're writing nonfiction?
When I write one of my nonfiction books, I write it the way I was trained to write, the way I assume people are supposed to write. I write an outline. The outline has as many points as there are chapters in the book. I expand each point into a chapter, and I'm done. It's not easy, but it's straightforward. I know how to do it. When I'm writing fiction, I also begin with an outline once I have the characters in mind, but the outline usually has little to do with the final product, and I'll tell you why. It's because I'm one of those authors who discovers in chapter 4 that my characters have become sufficiently complex that they won't go ahead and do for me what I needed them to do in Chapter 5. They resist. They push back. And so I have to rejigger my outline a bit in order to get the characters doing things that are plausible in light of the way that they've developed.
Now, you sound like you have a very orderly process for writing. You say it's not easy, but you make it sound easy. Would you describe it? What's your workspace like when you're working on a thriller? Do you have to actually storyboard this? Do you have to put it up on the wall, that timeline that you describe?
It's funny you mention that. My very first novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, had a storyboard. My kids used to tease me about it. I had one of those presentation boards they use for kids' science projects, and I had a little file card stuck all over with the different events. I moved them around, but I quickly abandoned that. I found it was too constraining. And so I find that when I write, actually nowadays, I write almost all of my work in the same spot. That is, I have a study at home. I sit in the study, usually at night. That's when I write the best. When it's dark is the right time to write thrillers. And although I have an outline, I never consult the outline unless I get stuck.
So you need to write in the dark. So I'm wondering if there's a terrible thunderstorm that moves through your area that you rush to the computer as fast as you can because the elements are just perfect for writing a thriller.
You know, it's an interesting question. When I write my nonfiction, I can write it anywhere, on vacation, I can write in the daytime, I can write in my office. But the thrillers I can write effectively only in my study and only in the dark. And I do write in the daytime sometimes, but it does help if it's dreary. A snowstorm, I've found, and in Connecticut we have a lot of those from December to March, is a really good time to write. It's very quiet outside. I have to have dead quiet and preferably many hours of dead quiet in order to write.
When you write thrillers, you're often writing about people who are doing scary things or people who are afraid because people are trying to do scary things to them. So do you have to push the limits yourself? Do you take on hobbies that perhaps lead your adrenaline to elevate a bit so you know what it's like to feel like your life might come to an end at any
moment? Well, I don't know. I don't pick up an axe in order to write an axe murderer necessarily, but it is true that there is an aspect, for me at least, of writing thrillers that involves much more emotion than writing works of nonfiction. I pour myself into them. And in particular, I am quite interested in how the characters react to stress. I myself react very badly to stress. There are some people who are exhilarated by stress. Their adrenaline pumps, they do great work. I need to be calm. But I try to remember how bad I feel when I'm stressed and upset. So I impose that, if you will, on my characters. Because a lot of what interests me about thrillers, it isn't so much what's really waiting around the corner. It's what the character is worried might be waiting around the corner. Those fears that go through the character's mind, whether exaggerated or not, and the way those fears affect what the character does next. So, for example, in my novel Palace Council, there was a fellow who was tortured in the Far East during the Vietnam era, and he was tortured by being, in a way that was actually used then, by being bound by the ankles and lowered upside down into a tank of ice-cold water, just over and over again without asking him any questions. So in the rest of the story, he doesn't have nightmares exactly or flashbacks. But he's jumpy about what might wait around the rest of the next corner. Although he doesn't consciously think about all this, it affects the way he looks at all the other twists and turns the rest of the story. Not only is he jumpy, but he becomes more prone, if you will, to violence himself as he works through perhaps whatever it was that happens to him. That's what interests me, the way that we respond to stress and fear and often to horror.
What are you working on next? What's your next thriller?
I have a kind of courtroom thriller coming out next summer 2012, but it's a courtroom thriller with a twist. It takes place in the 1860s, and it's an imaginary trial of Abraham Lincoln. If Abraham Lincoln had not been assassinated, there were members of Congress who actually wanted to try to remove him from office. And so in my novel coming out next year, I imagine what that might have been like. I imagine what might have happened had President Lincoln been placed on trial for high crimes and misdemeanors in the Senate of the United States.
Stephen Carter, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, too. Thank you so much, Michelle.
That was Stephen Carter. He's the author of several best-selling thrillers, including The Emperor of Ocean Park and Jericho's Fall.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A new report warns that the U.S. is falling well behind other countries in the proportion of adults with a college education. Researchers say the decline could have devastating economic and social consequences for the country. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The statistics compiled by the study titled The College Completion Agenda are sobering. No more than 40% of the U.S. adult population has a college degree, and even though most high school graduates enroll in college, only about half earn an undergraduate degree within 6 years. The completion rate drops even more in community colleges, where only about a quarter earn a degree in 3 years or less.
It's a very serious problem. People like never before in the United States, understand how critical it is to get an education.
Gaston Caperton is president of the College Board, which commissioned the study. He says the United States is losing its competitive advantage in the world because it's not producing nearly enough people with the level of education necessary to keep high-paying jobs from leaving the country. The study doesn't single out any one cause, in part because there are so many. But it does cite students' transition from high school to college as a major issue. For example, the commission found that more than a quarter of college students require remedial classes in reading, writing, and math. Community colleges know this all too well.
Okay, so then you would say, yeah, you have one class left to graduate.
At Northern Virginia Community College this time of year, counselors are booked solid, advising students about fall courses. Mark Mannheimer says it's not just academics, though. There are other reasons students struggle. The cost of college keeps climbing, and many students just can't juggle school, family, and work.
Work can't certainly be the thing that suffers, because that's what's generating the money. So it ends up being academics that falls off. And as soon as students start to receive lower marks, we see that students kind of lose faith quickly, and eventually they just stop enrolling.
Every year, students' needs get more expensive and more complex, says financial aid counselor Samaritan Johnson.
From teenagers to also single moms or families or older, people that have just lost their jobs that are coming back to try to get degrees, so we deal with a lot of students.
The concerns of those counselors are real, and I agree with them.
But, says the College Board's Gaston Caperton, the main reason the United States now ranks 12th in college completion among 36 developed nations is because from kindergarten to high school, students are not getting a quality education. And even if they do make it to college, they often lack focus.
Too many students go to the community colleges because they don't know what else to do.
The study makes 10 recommendations that Caperton says could help repair the education pipeline by expanding preschool, making K-12 education more rigorous, raising the quality of teachers, and making college more accessible and affordable. Caperton says the consensus now is that this nation's education deficit is no less urgent or threatening than the economic crisis we're in.
If you want to have a good job and a good income, you have to get a better education. And people are deeply concerned about this.
Which is not to say that this can't become one more study gathering dust on a shelf somewhere, says Caperton. He's betting it won't. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, Back Talk, where you talk back to us about this week's programs. We'll hear what you have to say. But first, it's time for our Faith Matters conversation. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today, we want to talk about a building, the proposed Islamic Center, a couple of blocks from Ground Zero. You may have heard about this. At a meeting last week to discuss the planned building, opponents shouted down supporters of the project.
I hope you, and I'm not racist, thank you. No, I'm not. You're saying that so that it makes it sound like I'm racist, and I could not be more further from the truth of racism.
Let her continue
her remarks.
Thank you. It's okay.
I apologize to Dave's up there.
We need to get the police to quiet this person. We need to have freedom of speech. I'm asking for the police to quiet this man.
Please. Now, this particular building has gotten a lot of attention because of all the complicated feelings about the Ground Zero site. In fact, similarly angry debates are being heard elsewhere in the country where mosques or Islamic community centers have been proposed, and even sometimes where they have not been. Now, the anger part has been well attested to, but what we are most interested in is whether there are models for how a community can get beyond these volatile reactions and move perhaps toward more constructive dialogue. So, to have that conversation, we called Rich Harwood. He is the president and founder of the Harwood Institute. That's a nonprofit that helps facilitate community discussion. He's with us from member station KNPR in Las Vegas. Welcome, Rich. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Michelle. Good to be with you.
So just to make it clear, the center in New York has already been approved, and the issue now is whether or not the building should receive special landmark preservation status, which would mean it, the 13-story building couldn't be torn down. But the center is likely to move forward regardless, but the fact is there are a lot of people who are still very angry about it. Maybe they just found out about it. What steps would you take to address these feelings?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to understand that there are a lot of undercurrents in American society right now, people's frustration about the economy, mortgage foreclosures, immigration laws. So we're hearing some of that frustration. So I think the first step is we have to let people vent their frustrations. But we then have to move beyond that pretty quickly. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves is not whether or not we should approve the building of a mosque, But first, what kind of community do we want to live in? And what will it take for us to get that kind of community? And then where does building a mosque fit into that? We have to get to a larger conversation about people's aspirations for their communities, not their fears and preconceived notions and maybe their prejudices.
You recently wrote on your blog about a similar debate among gubernatorial candidates in Tennessee, where candidates were pressed to take a position whether they would allow a mosque to go forward in their neighborhoods. And you say, quote, "In my old neighborhood, there were always concerns about a rapidly growing church down the street, but working out zoning issues is radically different from whether we allow mosques to be built at all in communities." And why is that?
Well, I think, there might be legitimate zoning issues about how tall a building is or what its front looks like or any number of technical issues, which is pretty much what zoning is about. Whether or not we're going to allow in this country, a pluralistic country where we have freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom to assemble, whether or not we're going to allow mosques to be built is a much larger issue than some technical aspect of zoning laws.
Well, recently, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg spoke to this point. He said, quote, "If you are religious, you do not want the government picking religions, because what do you do the day they don't pick yours?" But there are those who say this isn't about religion so much as it is about terrorism. There are those who say, well, thing one, they associate mosques with breeding grounds for terrorists, be they foreign-born or native-born. And for other people, they say it's just too sensitive, it's just too soon, 9/11 is too recent, and they still have raw feelings about this, that they just feel it's insensitive. What do you say to that?
Well, I think people do have raw feelings about 9/11 still. I think they have raw feelings about a lot of things that are happening in American public life right now. What I say is that we have two choices. We can try to tamp down those raw feelings and try to tell people to go home and not say very much. And what we know is those raw feelings will only fester. Or we can try to open up spaces in our communities for people to talk about these issues, to work through them, and to figure out how we want to move ahead together as part of the same community or same state or same nation in some cases. And my hope is that those folks on the far right or far left who seem to be dominating this debate will be told, look, your point of views are welcomed, but there are many other points of view in this country and we need to hear them.
Well, to that end, Sarah Palin, the former vice presidential candidate, has become, you know, quite a player in conservative politics, sent a series of Twitter posts on Sunday asking the Muslim community to move away from the site in the interest of healing. I mean, she's suggesting that people may have a right to build a site there, but they should make the gesture to the larger community as she put it, in the interest of healing. What do you make of that argument?
Well, you know, this is your segment on faith, right? And mm-hmm. and forgiveness actually often begins with those who have been perceived to be wronged in something, not those who have necessarily perpetrated it. And so what I would say is that I would hope that former Governor Palin would step forward and say, here's my point of view. But instead of me just telling you my point of view, let's talk about what it would mean to create some space for healing. What are the kinds of things we actually need to do to move forward? I've yet to hear those from many of the political leaders who are stepping forward to talk about this issue. They're demagoguing, they're bullying people, they're pushing people into corners. And I think that only is a negative in terms of the kind of society we're trying to create and how society can move through this.
What do you say to those who say, I don't want to engage with this? I lost loved ones here. Mm-hmm. This is too raw for me. I do not mm-hmm. want to engage in this community. I do not want to be reminded of this. It's still too mm-hmm. painful.
I can understand that. You know, I unfortunately lost my best friend in one of those towers on 9/11. I actually saw it unfold before my eyes as I was watching TV. And I waited for any number of days to hear whether or not he was alive or not. I understand the rawness of this. I understand the deep feelings that people have about this. And I can understand that for some people, it's still too hard to talk about. But there are millions more who can talk about this and need to talk about this. And we need to create the spaces in our communities for that conversation to occur.
One thing I think has been lost in all this is that there are many Muslims who lost their lives on 9/11, both
10%.
At the World Trade Center, both and at the Pentagon, that there are people of the Muslim faith who lost their lives there. But just going back to the original question, so now that people have vented, and you actually say venting does have its place, that people should be allowed a vehicle to express their feelings. Now that that's happened, what next? What's the next step you think people should take in communities where they are grappling with this?
Well, as I mentioned before, I think the very next step is that we need to start, the next question has to be, what kind of community do we want to live in? This has to be framed in terms of our aspirations, our desire to be part of something larger than ourselves, to help us remember that we are connected to one another in our communities. And my experience has been, whether it's on issues like this or education or healthcare or any number of issues, is that when we can start with the larger context of our aspirations for our community, we can begin to see ourselves in that discussion, and we also begin to take more ownership of the discussion and trying to figure out how to move forward from where we are.
Richard Harwood is the president of the Harwood Foundation. That's a nonprofit that encourages people to engage in their communities, to use their language. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that inspires and guides people to step forward and take action rooted in their community and stay true to themselves. The Institute works with individuals, organizations, and communities to turn outward and develop their ability to make more intentional choices and judgments that lead to impact. So there you go. That's what the Harwood Institute tries to do. He was with us from KNPR in Las Vegas. Thank you so much, Rich.
Thank you, Michelle.